Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, why are people leaving the Golden State and the Valley in droves? The findings of a new study gives us clues as to why the Valley is losing its luster for a huge portion of the population, and why the Obama administration may have changed its tune when it comes to teens working on farms. Plus, how well do we respond to a disaster? The topic of this month's California Reads. But first, new census figures and a new report out by the Fresno Council of Government shows that more people are now leaving the Golden State and the Central Valley than moving in. And new population trend shows a huge decline in what was once the majority population and why they may be leaving. But first, Joe Moore talked to several Californians about why they left the Golden State.
California's history is one of emigration. From the gold rush to the technology boom in Silicon Valley, for generations, people have moved to the Golden State to seek a better life. For many, the California dream of sunshine and a good job with a relaxed lifestyle is still a reality. But with the struggling economy, high taxes, cuts in education and other programs, many Californians are increasingly choosing to leave the Golden State for other locales. And the Central Valley is no exception. To learn a little more about what's making people leave California faster than new residents arrive, we talked to people who have recently made the move. Travis Sheridan had a good job in Fresno, working with budding entrepreneurs at the Central Valley Business Incubator. But earlier this year, he and his girlfriend chose to move to St. Louis, largely because of the struggling economy.
Gina is a librarian and was laid off once during the year of 2011, and then also took a couple of pay cuts, was eventually hired back at the library, but kind of saw the writing on the wall that it may not be that sustainable long-term or that comfortable long-term. And conversely, St. Louis, Missouri, is very friendly to libraries. They have two very healthy library systems.
He says technology has leveled the playing field, and states like Missouri are now able to compete with California in ways they weren't in the past.
I think California might have been a net importer at one time because it was such a wealthy economic engine. From the housing market to the job market, everything seemed to be in surplus in California. And so if I was a business, I wanted to be around a community that seemed to have a healthy amount of disposable income. Now, with the flattening of, you know, the business environment, I can run a business globally from any community. And so now people start looking to those communities, states and cities that have the most favorable business environment and business climate. And California, over time, is starting to prove out that it's not that friendly to business. I mean, when you have Hollywood that's starting to lose movie production to states like Texas and New York and other states, heck, if we can't keep Hollywood in Hollywood, what will stay in California?
For others like writer Kathy Rehart, the move was more about health, as the polluted skies of the Central Valley forced Kathy's move to Oregon.
I moved because the doctor told me I had to get out of the smog. I had developed a very serious lung condition. It was due to the smog in the valley, the air pollution. I had never, ever thought I would leave. In fact, when we did the movie for the Susquehcentennial, I was one of the narrators, and the last thing I said was, there's something about the valley that just makes you never want to leave. It was the farthest thing from my mind.
The opportunity for a better job and a better quality of life led Katie Johnson to relocate from Fresno to Ogden, Utah.
Job opportunities in Fresno weren't so great. You know, I was really sad to leave my friends. That was the hardest thing. I had a great community and a great network in Fresno. I loved my colleagues at Fresno State. And so that was a tough decision. But I was excited to move to Utah because it's such a beautiful state. I've traveled there before, and I ski, and I had an opportunity to come out and check out Salt Lake City, which, again, is 40 miles south, and there was just food culture, art culture. It was just seemed like a great place to live and a great place to raise a family.
Others, like Chris Madrid French, a California native, have bounced around the country. She came back to California in search of her dream job. But when things changed, she and her family moved to Florida.
As much as I loved California and wanted to be there, the schools weren't getting enough money. A lot of the things I cared about were being cut off. The state parks were closing, the schools, the librarian was going to rotate, so they were closing the library in our kids' elementary school. And these are things we really cared about.
Kathy Rehart says she's not alone. Many other people have chosen to leave California and move to Oregon.
In fact, I joined the newcomers group and met a number of people from Fresno.
Katie Johnson says she, too, has met a number of former Californians in Utah, and most of them feel the same way about their former state.
I think the general consensus is I love Utah, and I haven't looked back since I left California, and I kind of feel the same way, too. I mean, you can buy more home here. It's a lot cheaper here, and it's a beautiful place to live, and the people are so friendly.
And that issue of quality of life is a recurring theme amongst all the people we talk to. Here's Chris Madrid French.
We have a much bigger house. We have bigger property. The schools, even though they've been cut here, have better funding. The libraries have better funding. The state parks are still running. Everything's been cut, but not as deeply as California. In Florida, I don't pay any personal tax, state income tax. There's no state income tax for, there's only federal, no state. And that obviously helps us as a family, you know, balance our own economic survival here. And it's just given us an opportunity to live kind of the middle class lifestyle that we desire.
The people we heard from today certainly weren't the first to leave the Golden State, nor will they be the last. But their stories are nonetheless a sobering reminder of the many challenges California has to face in a changing world. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Well, as you can see, we have a very interesting topic on tap this morning. We'd love to have you join in as well. But here to discuss the issue with us is Barbara Steck, Deputy Director, Fresno Council of Governments, Kathy Chung, a demographer with COG, and Joel Kotkin, a leading demographer in the U.S. and professor at Chapman University in Orange. And he's also the author of The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Professor Kotkin, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
And Kathy Chung, and as well as Barbara Steck. Okay, you all listen to the report. Before we move on with the questions, I'd just really like to have your opinion of what you just heard. I mean, you had very personal reasons why all of the folks that we talked to left the Central Valley and left California, and a lot of it really showed up in the studies that you all have done. Let's start with you, Professor Kotkin.
Well, I think this is what we're seeing as we start to drill down on who's leaving and who's not coming, if you will. The real weakness seems to be middle-class families, particularly younger families, people who I mean, you have some people moving in when they're older, but older people tend to move a little bit less. What we're seeing is that people are beginning to feel that their long-term prospects are not that great unless they are in one of the really heavily favored sectors. And the problem the Central Valley has, I think in many ways, is that it benefited from growth spreading in some senses from the coast into the interior. But now that growth is not as strong as it was. And even in a place like Silicon Valley, you're creating jobs, but you're not creating anything like the jobs you were creating before. And really, it doesn't even spill over to Oakland, much less to the Central Valley. So I think that you just have a problem, which is that people and businesses who are saying, well, if I really am not at the very high end of the food chain in San Francisco or Silicon Valley or even Hollywood. What's the point of being in California? I might as well be someplace else, whereas I think almost every interviewee talked about, life is a little bit easier, costs are a little bit lower, and now the great traditional California advantage, which was opportunity, it's really, in many ways, you do better in lots of other places.
Yeah. Let's hear from Kathy Chung. What are the numbers show when we talk about people leaving? What are the numbers show?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the eight valley counties, the San Joaquin Valley, they got together and commissioned a report. The latest population projection had been conducted by the State Department of Finance several years ago. And the State Department of Finance was one agency and that we all looked to get data for both projections and current populations. But because it was outdated, we just commissioned the report, and it came out with some pretty startling results. It showed that compared to the DOF projection...
DOF is...
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the Department of Finance.
Okay.
Yeah, they're ones that every few years come out with a new projection for each county in California, and many of us always look to that agency to look for our population data. But they hadn't come out with one for quite a long time. In fact, they came. The previous one was released before the 2010 census, and we realized that after the 2010 census came out, we had been overestimating what California and the Valley counties' populations were, and then also the economic downturn. So anyway, what we found out is that the actual population of the Valley was actually 250,000 less people in 2010. We had slowly overestimated it. And because of the economic downturn, this new study predicts that the average annual growth rate will only be 1.3% compared to about 2% from the Department of Finance. So instead of growing more than doubling what we thought by 2050, we're actually only going to grow by 70%.
Uh-huh. And it also showed a decline in California's population as well as far as people moving in.
Yes. Well, this study only focused on the Valley, but other studies, especially from some recent census studies.
Right. The recent census report showed, I'm trying to see if I have the numbers in front of me, it was really, wasn't it like 700,000
yes.
Less
mm-hmm.
As far as people have being moved out. Here it is right here. Mm-hmm. It showed that nearly, I think it was close to 1 million, but it was over a period of time that left California. Mm-hmm. Now, when we compare, let's try to compare Professor Konkin and the other two guests, what we see in the Central Valley and what we see in the state as a whole. And what I'm hearing is a lot of this is really, I think, Professor Konkin, from your readings, you say a lot of it has to do with policymaking in California, and it's also the economy.
Right. And I think that part of the issue of, by the way, I was interested, the Department of Finance numbers are absurd, but just to make sure we don't just blame them, in Southern California, the population estimates of of SCAG were about 3 million off. So, I mean, we're clearly, underestimating what the effect is of the policy framework that we have here in California. And I'm actually more concerned even going forward because we are now, with some of the climate change-related legislation, really waging a sort of a policy war, and the rest of the country isn't part of it. So, in other words, not only do we have, justifiably, some strong environmental laws, but we're now adding to it something that deals with global climate change, which is not directly tied to just our local economy and our local environment. And that is going to create tremendous problems for the state in general, but particularly for the Central Valley, because a lot of what the Central Valley growth is built around are things like agriculture, warehousing, manufacturing, and those are right in the crosshairs of this legislation. So if we don't make some significant change in the policy framework, I don't see how this process of deterioration is significantly reversed.
Barbara.
I think that Professor Kotkin is right on that we have SB 375, which is related to greenhouse gases, and the councils of governments in the state are required to develop planning documents that include what is referred to as a sustainable community strategy. And this is the reason that we commissioned the study in the first place, was we felt that with the economy changing so drastically over the last several years, that we needed new data. And so we commissioned the study because we needed to know, as we went into our planning process, just how this would affect the Valley and Fresno County in particular.
You both mentioned legislation having to do with greenhouse gas emissions. But on the other hand, then how do you rectify that? Because even in the report, and we know here in the Valley, our bad air situation has caused a lot of problems, not only earlier death, but a host of respiratory illness. So how do you manage the two?
Well, I mean, it seemed to me that those are two separate issues. I mean, one of the problems with the climate change legislation is it is based on a sort of global considerations, which, you know, if you're just dealing with the air pollution, that is not necessarily the same issue as greenhouse gases. So it's, in other words, the question is, where is our focus? If the focus is cleaning up the air, I could see that being a very long-term positive. But if you're imposing a series of economic conditions, let's say, on energy use by a manufacturer, and you say, well, you know, you can't do this because it's going to cost 50% more to do it in California, I would argue in many cases that actually it is against the climate change issue, because if you move a business from that would have been in Fresno to Texas or to China, their carbon footprint will likely go up considerably because of the climatic changes, because of the regulatory situation. So, in other words, you're in a weird conundrum where you're essentially driving businesses from a relatively energy-efficient state to less energy-efficient places. It's just kind of an irony, and, of course, it's the people of places like the Central Valley, much more so, by the way, than people in Silicon Valley or Hollywood, who are going to be most severely affected.
Okay, before we continue discussion, I'd like to invite the public to join us. I'd like to hear what you think. Why do you think people are leaving the Golden State and the Central Valley? And what would be some of your suggestions as far as what we could do to make this a better place and to keep people here? We'd like to hear from you. Please call us at 800-224-8989. 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. And as he mentioned, one of the things that we've talked about and one of the things that we saw specifically in this is the economy and economic issues for people and the housing situation. A lot of people before the bust were totally priced right out of a home. And specifically, excuse me, in the Bay Area, you still can't afford a home. Mm-hmm. How has that impacted people in their decisions, and how will it impact this region? What trends are we seeing when it comes to housing and income?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think some of the trends in housing, I think everybody's housing went down in California, so that's maybe not as an important issue. There was one time when people came to the Valley because housing was easy to obtain, but it's less of an issue now. There used to be a time when, you know, owning a home was the American dream, but less and less people are thinking about that as an investment. And so that's not as important. People used to come to the Valley because of the low cost of living, but people are not doing that as much. So
I think a follow-up study that we have based on these population numbers that we just received is to look at the marketability of the housing stock, because one of the things that we have been promoting is to look at more efficient use of land and maybe a tighter development form. And we're looking to see what are the housing products that will be desirable in this area. So are people looking for smaller lots? Are they looking for multiple family? Are they looking for large lots? the traditional suburban development. So we're really looking forward to getting that information so that we can provide that as part of our planning process to the development community.
I hear a lot of this stuff about, well, you know, people want multifamily. You look at any survey, vast majority of people want single family homes. Now, if we can develop them maybe in a little more compact way or a little more intelligently, I think that makes sense. But, you know, frankly, if the Valley tries to go and or is forced by the state to go into a sort of higher, high density multifamily kind of environment, I don't see any reason why people would come there. I mean, frankly, to me, you know, living in high density in a city in the Valley is like, why would I do that? I mean, high density only makes sense when there is a high level of amenity. Other words, you can take New York as an extreme example. A few parts of Los Angeles, you can say that. To live in downtown Fresno in a five-story apartment building, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as such a great sale. You have to figure out how to continue to have this market for single-family homes. You can do it more intelligently, but fundamentally, land and space, privacy, these are still the things that every survey I look at, the vast majority want. The vast majority of millennials, the new generation coming up, the vast majority of immigrants, this is what they want. If you give that up, then I don't see where your competitive advantage is going to remain much longer because, you know, there is no point in living in high density in
what would be considered a rural area.
I don't see where that is a attractive option for all but maybe a few people.
Okay, let's listen to George from Bakersfield. George?
Yes, I'm here.
And your comment, please?
Well, I'm an attorney. A client of mine has just moved part of their business to Arizona. And they had a side business making candy, which turned out to be very profitable. So they decided to try and do that in their Arizona operation. And I've just talked to them. They just came back. And they are still kind of in shock about how easy it was to start a business in Arizona. They called up when they had the building built that they were going to use. They called up the local planning people to see what kind of permits they needed. And the person they talked to was very helpful and said, well, come on in this afternoon and you can sign the papers. And they said, well, how long does it take? And he said, oh, it takes about 20 minutes. And, well, how long does it take to get in business? Well, once you get the paper, you're in business. And they can't believe it because they've been doing business in California for 10 years, and they expect it to take at least 90 days to be able to turn on their machinery. So they are now moving all of their business to Arizona.
Well, I think, George, thank you so much for your comment, but also Professor Konkin, you mentioned that too in your article, and it's been a major complaint for people in California, especially the business community. We have heard that for years about this being a unfriendly business climate, and also here in the Central Valley as well.
Well, and I think that this is, this story that this gentleman just shared with us is very typical. I mean, very often what will happen is a business may maintain its headquarters operation, let's say, in Silicon Valley or someplace in even Central California. I do a lot of work. I've done a lot of work in Salinas. But when they expand elsewhere. And that's really been the thing that's really hurt, is that when a business says, I'm going to expand what I'm doing, and let's say in agriculture, they'll say, well, you know, I can go somewhere else and the water supplies are still going to be guaranteed. But if I stay in California, I don't know what's coming next. I mean, it's not just the existing regulation that I hear about. It's what's coming next. What new crazy law is Sacramento going to pass and impose on us? And that creates a climate of uncertainty for many businesses. So not only is it the positive experience in the other states, it's the fear of things happening here. And part of it is that, frankly, California has become a one-party state. And business is completely without any influence, really, on the state level. And that means that there is no restraint on, you know, even the craziest legislation.
Do you have that? Did that come up in either one of your studies? I know you did it specifically for the Central Valley, but people talking about it not being easy, just not the right kind of climate to do some of the things they want to do.
Well, most of our study concluded it was the economy finding jobs, that most people moved out because of jobs.
And that's been a been a problem here for a while. We saw a change basically brought on by the boom in the housing market. But as soon as that went away, we were right back where we've been, and that is huge unemployment numbers. And at some point, we keep talking about educating our workforce, and we have educated people here who cannot find jobs. So as we just heard, they do leave.
I think that was a recurring thing, too, at the in the first segment with the young people that were interviewed, is that they left to find employment elsewhere. And it definitely is something that we have to address, because we need to diversify the economy here in the Valley so that there are new innovations in the job market.
One of the things I'd like to touch on before we get too close to having to wrap up because of our time is that what we saw in population trends, I think, is what will really be surprising to a lot of people. If you, when you look at the San Joaquin Valley, and this is what the study from the Council of Government showed, is that what was once the majority population in whites are the main group that's leaving. And what we show is that in 2010, you have a million, you know, 400 plus in the population. But by 2050, that number declines by 892,000 people to just a little over a half a million. And then on the other hand, the Hispanic population, which is almost, you know, a little bit more at this point than the white population of 1,820,000, increases to over 3 million. The increase to over 5 million. So what was the majority group is now in 2050 at a half a million people, and the Hispanic population is now at 5 million people. What does that say, and what can we expect when it comes to what we'll see here in the Central Valley?
Yep. The only question I would raise is that, and looking at immigration, the immigration numbers are dropping so quickly now, partially because of the economy, partially because of lower birth rate in Mexico, a whole bunch of factors. I'm not necessarily sure that these projections of the Hispanic population are going to hold up either over time.
Because census did show that not only were Californians leaving, but Mexicans were also moving from the U.S. back to Mexico between 2005 and 2010, over a million. So, but you base these numbers on what? Not necessarily was an immigration trend, but more of what we have is a lot of migration from different counties within the Central Valley.
Yeah. It turned out it's a phenomenon that's not occurring just in the Central Valley, but all of California.
Yeah.
And it's been happening for several years where we're becoming more diversified. And a lot of that in recent times is because of there's a lot of foreign in-migration into California and the Central Valley. But as Joe said, that is definitely going down now. A census study recently showed that in the last couple of years, in at least the Central Valley or San Joaquin Valley, it has virtually stopped. It's the amount of domestic and foreign migration has been even. And a lot of our increase is simply by birth, you know, minus deaths.
But also the birth rate for immigrants or Mexicans have also gone down as well.
Oh, yes. Many of them have, you know, well, for example, like Southeast Asian, for example, they've been here in California for about 40 years. And so they have adopted the way of life of, you know, the United States, so their birth rate has gone down, and then also with the other ethnic groups too.
But the two major groups that I think your study showed was the Hispanic population and a continued increase in the Asian population. Here in the Central Valley, because I grew
up here. Mm-hmm. The African American population is just about nil.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes for its own set of concerns when it comes to political power and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do we make of this? Where we are right now, let's sort of wrap this up. What do we make of this and where we are?
Well, I think the biggest thing is if we don't have a change in the basic business climate and trajectory of the state economy, particularly for the Central Valley, all these trends are just going to continue. And you'll probably see over time, probably as we're already seeing in Los Angeles County and the other coastal counties, a rapid aging of the population and continuing migration of young families out to other states. And, you know, that's basically, classic case of, eating your seed corn.
Yeah, and that's what it, and it did show that in the studies. And what you're saying is middle-class families with children are leaving, and the older population is staying, and that's going to present another whole host of issues of concerns and issues we're going to have to address because, you know, the high-earning, high-powered kind of folks are the ones that are leaving.
Well, there's no question that, you know, that this is a concern, and I think that there are activities going on. I know locally in Fresno, there's a concerted effort to try to bring, they call them the boomerang generation. They're trying to bring these young people back. Kids go away to school, and many of them stay there. But I think it's ironic that when a lot of these young people want to start a family, they tend to come back to the Valley. So, that, you know, they come back to their roots. And now there's really a proactive program to actually bring these kids back to the Valley.
But you know what? If there aren't the jobs to keep them,
that's right. That's right.
They may have those kids, and when they're young, they will leave.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to wrap this up. Thank you all. I found it to be a very interesting topic and discussion, one that we're probably going to continue, especially as this information comes in. Professor Joel Kotkin, professor at Chapman University and a leading demographer, Barbara Steck, Deputy Director of Fresno Council of Governments, and Kathy Chung, Senior Regional Planner with Fresno Council of Governments. Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Appreciate having
you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Teens working down on the farm. The Obama administration proposed new restrictions on teens working on farms. Labor leaders and child welfare advocates were for it, but there was a strong opposition from farmers, many saying this would stop their kids from working on the family farm or even some ag students. Well, the administration has backed off, and here to talk about this issue with us is Paul Bittencourt, a family farmer from Kerman, and he's also an instructor at the University of Phoenix, and Kenny Watkins, Vice President of the California Farm Bureau Federation. Thank you both for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
You know,
good
morning. When I first saw this, I think maybe the intent was people thinking, you know what, if we open this up and there are teens working on the farm, you could end up with, you know, young immigrants coming here as teens and working and not being in really good working conditions. The whole idea of, like many of us who grew up here and worked on a farm, the whole idea of it was, you know, for a local farmer, it would be, you know, this is what my kids do after school kind of a situation. So I think it was just the different perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody has ever been talking about child labor. That's been a dead issue here for a century, and we're absolutely concerned about the safety of the kids because there are kids. So absolutely, this was how do you create a work ethic with kids if they don't have an opportunity to work? And that's one of the things farm kids get. By doing chores around the farm, they develop a work ethic that serves them the rest of their lives.
And even for some ag students, it's the experience.
Absolutely. It's priceless experience.
I would also think that it's also bodes well when it comes to the future of farming, Mr. Watkins, when introducing young people to the ag industry.
Well, today farmers only represent 2% of the population, and it gives them the opportunity to expose their children to the love of their life. What they love doing is farming. And, you know, if you have to wait till you're 18 to get introduced to that, could create a challenge for continuing the family farms in the future.
But let's – I'll play devil's advocate and take it from the other approach. But it's not often, and we don't hear it a lot, but there have been some cases of young people, mostly migrants, ending up working in the fields in not very good conditions. And so I think there was this effort to say, okay, we have to kind of protect it, against this.
The biggest portion of this law wasn't about that. California law today already says you can't hire anyone under 16 years of age to do anything that's hazardous. There's a whole list of things. What the main part of this law was, it redefined the parental exemptions. You know, in the past, it was defined that if it was a family member, they could work on the farm without these restrictions, but they wanted to redefine it so you couldn't work on your grandparents' farm, your aunt and uncle's farm. If your family farm happened to be in a partnership or a corporation, your children couldn't even work on it. That was the main issue with this.
And what do you think caused it to? Did farmers have the opportunity to really state their case on this? I'm sure you were all very outspoken and perhaps led to the administration sort of backing off on this whole issue.
Yeah, as big as issues, this was in California. The Midwest, I want to say, completely came unglued, you know. California, a lot of our elected representatives are elected from urban areas because that's where the population is, but yet the Midwest still has ag constituents, congressmen, and they heard a lot from a lot of different people.
I think there were reports of tens of thousands of emails and letters and phone calls being made on this issue in the last couple of weeks.
Let's talk a little bit about when you talk about the whole issue of young people working on farms and bringing up the next generation of farmers. How important is this going to be when you look at how our workforce is aging, let's say?
Well, the average age of a farmer in California today is 58 years old. I mean, we're almost skipping generations passing the farm on as it is. And the basis for this whole regulation was pretty much unfounded. USDA released a report here recently that shows that child injuries on the farm has reduced 46% between 2001 and 2009. Those statistics don't support increasing the regulations.
Well, and it's not. In addition to that, I make my living growing food and fiber, not filling out forms. And this is just another example of the feds not getting their job done and making it harder on family farmers to get their job done. And it's just the wrong equation. So in addition to the aging, you have every regulation that comes down makes it harder for family farmers to stay in business. The larger farms can hire environmental officers. I can't hire somebody to do that. I've got to take extra time to do those sorts of things. And these kind of things squeeze out the family farmers. They make it harder and harder, so our kids look at it and go, why would we bother doing this?
You know, and that is a situation, and we've seen a lot of that. You hear a lot of people who are smaller farmers, they family farms, and having to compete with the large corporation or mega farms. How does that impact you? Does it make it very tough?
Well, the government is driving agriculture to that. It's just like, you know, two generations ago, the dairies were family operations. Now you can't afford to have all the consultants and all. They've driven them to get larger so you can afford to have the mass to hire enough people to deal with all the regulation. And it's the way this writing regulation is part of the problem. This administration has, if this was done through Congress, we'd all have our voice. The grassroots have a better opportunity to air their voice. You know, this administration's done the same thing with the Clean Water Act. They had the Oberstar bill trying to go through Congress for years where they wanted to redefine the definition of navigable waters. The grassroots were able to have their voice heard there. then they lost, and so then now they're just writing a regulation to do what they want to do, where they lost in Congress. Really, Congress is being made insignificant, and they need to stand up, and they're the ones that decide and voice and air what the country needs, and instead of having to defend and stop these regulations that are trying to be pushed out down without community input.
And this event with the child labor thing is another example of the feds making it harder for family farms to survive. We've got globalization. We've got competition. We've got rising costs. And the irony of the same people who say they want to support small family farms are making it harder for us to survive.
What does it take? What are some of the things that need to happen to make it possible for farmers like yourself, Mr. Bencourt, to continue to not just survive but thrive? I mean, because we're seeing fewer and fewer.
Absolutely. Well, the good news is right now commodity prices are coming up, so the economics are in our favor. And we want to address the issues, you know, the worker safety, child worker safety. We want to take care of the environment. We've just got to get these regs where they're user-friendly, that they get the job done instead of being cumbersome. You know, 10 years ago, we're talking about air quality, and one of the regs that was proposed that we water every dirt road on every farm in the county every day. How much water and energy would that absorb to do that? That was an unreasonable kind of regulation, and we get those all the time. If we could just keep it to the regs that get the job done, that would be a lot easier on us. Everybody could see that, support it, and implement it.
Then, you know, you mentioned that regulation, and then you have the other side of the coin where people talk about, you know, here we are in the Central Valley with some of the worst air. And there is, you know, effort to try to clean up our air. And along the way, I'm sure it ends up hurting some industries.
And again, that's a perfect example. You know, farmers have been actively involved in the pursuit of cleaner air. And if you look at the raw numbers, air quality has improved. Now, some of the advocates don't want to admit that, but the fact is the air quality has gotten better. Are we done? Of course not. But we'll just go back to my example. Unreasonable regulations aren't going to clean up the air. Reasonable ones are going to get accomplished, and they'll get done, and it'll get the job done. And that's what we need to be part of it. And as Kenny was saying, you know, the grassroots, this has to be started at the grassroots level, or let them participate. The good news is we have an amazing political system that involves self-government and interest. We've got people who are passionate on both sides and get in. And as long as that's a healthy dialogue, we can come up with rules and regs that benefit everybody.
Mr. Watkins, you pointed out the fact of the, you know, the average age of farmers being in the 50s. What are some of the things that can be done to really encourage young people to continue on in this business? Because you're right, if they see how hard it is and how difficult it is, you know, they don't want to take on that struggle.
Well, that's one of the college ag universities beginning of this year. One of the teachers has a beginning ag class, and they asked the class how many was excited about agriculture, and the majority of the class raised their hand. How many of you are concerned about the future of agriculture? A minority of the class raised their hands, and come to find out, the minority of that class were the ones that were born and raised on a farm. The other ones were raised in urban environments that are excited about being part of agriculture in the future. And the reason those that were born and raised on the deal, they see the regulation, the red tape, and the bureaucracy that we have to deal with every day. That you know, my grandparents and my great grandparents before, they got to stay home and work the ground and farm. It's a special day when I'm home on the ranch having to work and being able to work and do stuff and not worry about my BlackBerry or what's happening in Congress that day. You know, times have changed so much.
Juanita, they've just got to see that there's hope and opportunity, and they'll take on the task. You know, as long as they see there's a hope and an opportunity in agriculture, they'll be willing to put in the work, put in the hours, go to school, do all the hard work.
And ag has changed in so many ways too.
Absolutely.
I think for young people who are thinking about going into the ag industry, they really do have many more choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people ask if my kids are going to follow in the farm. My daughter teaches here in Sanger. My son joined the Army knowing he'd go overseas and get shot at rather than get involved in the farm because he's watched my wife and I struggle all of his life.
Well, if it's any solace for you, my daughter doesn't want to do what I do either.
Yeah, and it's wonderful that the kids have opportunities to do other things.
But is it for I think what you're saying, the only way the old family farms continue is that somebody, you know, takes up the heavy load and continues the work.
Like so many other things, there has to be a passion for it. There's a passion for what you do, and your daughter has another passion. You know, I have a passion for what I do. My kids have the freedom and opportunity to do something else. That's good for them. For us as a society, we need to be concerned that we are encouraging people to see the opportunities there are to get involved in agriculture. And that's harder and harder to do in the current climate.
Yeah, I can see. Well, let's do hope things change. Is so much a part of what and who we are here in the Central Valley. And I think all of us at one time or another probably worked on a farm as a teenager.
And it was a good experience.
And yeah, it was a good experience.
You learned what you didn't want to do and you figured out it was worth it to go do something else.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Paul Bittencourt, family farmer, always been involved in farming issues, and it's a pleasure to have you here. And Kenny Watkins, Vice President, California Farm Bureau Federation. Thank you both for taking the time to chat with us.
Thanks for your interest.
Thank you very much.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Now it's time for The Moral Is. Sometimes in order to get the most, you have to pay the most, or at least that's the conventional wisdom behind high compensation for CEOs. But what happens when the company in question is operated under the arm of the federal government? On our commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State business law professor Ida Jones says the result can be very costly to taxpayers.
What does the following recipe make? Layer an unlimited public purse to guarantee against losses. Substitute two privately owned institutions, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for two government-owned institutions. Sprinkle millions of dollars to executives to work for these agencies. Whip with lots of real estate rapidly increasing in value. Wait a few years. Finally, fold in lots of real estate rapidly decreasing in value. What do these ingredients create? According to Spencer Backus, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, this recipe created a $170 billion tax bill for U.S. taxpayers. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two privately owned financial agencies operated under the auspices of the U.S. government, paid executives top dollar to work for them. Last year, according to the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the top executives of Fannie Mae were entitled to base and deferred compensation ranging from $1.5 million to nearly $3 million. According to the FHFA, there were two key reasons to set compensation so high. First, to attract and retain executive talent, and second, to create a pay-for-performance environment for executives. The FHFA standards were developed in response to the multi-million dollar pay received by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac executives during 2009, during which time both agencies were placed into conservatorship for failing to remain financially healthy. The agency executives were paid even more, receiving millions of dollars in bonuses prior to 2009, all the while as these same executives did a poor job of predicting and responding to the decline in real estate values. In their defense, the FHFA argues that high executive compensation is required to recruit top talent. So you might ask, what sort of background earns an executive up to $3 million per year? And does it matter whether the executive is successful or not? Well, an examination of Fannie Mae's current CEO's background suggests that past success is not a criterion determining the amount of pay. Indeed, current Fannie Mae CEO Michael J. Williams did not make a lateral move from another financial institution to Fannie Mae. Instead, Mr. Williams rose through the ranks. He held several key positions during Fannie Mae's financial crises. Now, according to Fannie Mae's website, in November 2005, Mr. Williams was named Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, overseeing the Making Home Affordable program. In February 2008, he was put in charge of Fannie Mae's efforts to strengthen its financial and operational foundation. What was the agency's record under Mr. Williams' leadership? 7 months after his 2008 promotion, Fannie Mae was placed in conservatorship. This recipe apparently isn't a good one if the goal is financial stability in the housing market without taxpayer bailouts. You might rightly ask, how can ingredients be changed to reduce the public's likelihood to have to continue to bail out these agencies? This example demonstrates that higher pay isn't necessarily attracting better financial talent from outside the agency. And if there's no new leadership from outside the agency, the high pay does not seem warranted. And second, a key ingredient must be accountability. But accountability seems lacking if the regulatory agency postulates in its reports that the brain drain from the agency requires multi-million dollar salaries. Congress should go back to the kitchen and change this recipe to stem the loss to taxpayers. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Just how well do we respond to disasters? That's the topic of discussion for California Reads, Search for Democracy Initiative. The Kern County Library in Bakersfield is hosting this month-long discussion, and joining
you're
us now is Christy
Coons, rebroadcast Kern County of Valley
Library
Edition,
and the coordinator of Disaster and Democracy Community Reading and Discussion Initiative. Christy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yes, thanks for having us.
First of all, explain what the California Reads Searching for Democracy Initiative is about.
Right. It's a statewide initiative that is funded through Cal Humanities, formerly California Council for the Humanities, and the California Center for the Book. And it really started last summer when those two entities decided to fund and create a community-wide, statewide conversation that would get the public talking about the nature of our democracy. So they had 300 books that they started with that were possibilities for sparking such conversations. They narrowed it down to 5, and then they offered public libraries throughout the state an opportunity to apply for this grant using one or both or all of the books. In Kern County, we decided, well, we're kind of disaster prone, so with earthquakes and floods and a faulty dam, so we decided that we would use Rebecca Solnit's A Paradise Built in Hell and kind of look at democracy through the lens of disaster. When our democratic society is stressed the most, how do people, how do governance, how do they respond, and what happens is our democratic society either diminished or is it enhanced in times of
and so it's really taking a look at democracy and disaster as well as an everyday life. And I think the book explores a number of disasters such as 9/11, Hurricane
it
Katrina.
It does, yeah. She is a San Francisco Bay author, so perhaps it's no accident that she started with the 1906 San Francisco earthquake and fire. Then she goes to the 1917 Halifax explosion in the harbor there. A very interesting chapter on Mexico City's 1985 earthquake that changed the whole fabric of society there because of common people responding. And then, yes, she has extensive chapters on 9/11 and ending with Katrina.
And I think she does conclude that, you know, and I think it's something that we saw in every single one of these disasters, that first responders and ordinary citizens are the one that really, in the beginning, kind of come together.
Right, because as the point has been made, it probably is not, you know, the government that's going to come rescue you out of your home. It's probably your next-door neighbor that may or may not act. And, yes, so she argues this is a book with just so many themes, highly discussable. But she concludes that it is ordinary people that in acting, in performing acts of altruism and in extending mutual aid, and I think that's the important thing, neighbors helping neighbors, that really temporarily creates a kind of utopia, a kind of higher form of democracy, and that they do this with intense joy, because that's the nature, that's the basic nature of humans to want to help each other. So that is the case that she argues.
Now, this whole discussion of this topic for California Reads not only includes a book, but you have an evening with the author coming up as well, don't you?
Exactly, yes. We have had faculty panel discussions. We've had, you know, regular book discussions. We've had programs on homelessness. But our showcase program is coming up on May 10th, Thursday, May 10th, at the Beale Memorial Library, Kearns Library, and at 7 p.m. And the author will come down and really talk about these ideas that she holds, the arguments that she makes, and then she'll lead discussion and entertain questions and answers, and then she'll sign books for people that bring their books to the library, to the program. And I think people don't always understand. This is a book that has won multiple. When it was published in 2009, it was chosen as the best book of the year by New York Times, L.A. Times, The New Yorker, San Francisco Chronicle, Washington Post, and Chicago Tribune. This is an author that has really exciting ideas. And so sometimes I think that the public doesn't understand how exciting it is to hear from an author about their own ideas. So it will be a very, very engaging and enlightening evening for people.
Well, let's hope a lot of folks turn out. Sounds like a great, an interesting discussion and the opportunity to meet a wonderful author. Thank you so much, Christy Coons, for joining us this morning from the Kern County Library.
Thank you very much for asking us.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weber, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.